My guest today is Michelle Machado, TEDx speaker, global educator. She's lived and worked in four different continents and earned both a PhD and an MBA. She's known for her powerful TEDx talk, the one legacy we can't afford to pass down. Michelle's work focuses on helping people move from performance to presence in this digital age that thrives on distraction. We'll explore some insights on connection and how we can model a healthier legacy for the next generation. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you so much, Jim, for having me here. It is an absolute pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have you, Michelle. Let's start with a little bit about your background, you know, a little bit about your roots, your identity, your story. Now, you've lived in six countries across four continents: Kuwait, India, Canada, the UK, Hong Kong, Australia. Now, how has this multicultural experience shaped your understanding of connection and identity?
Thank you, Jim, for that question. I mean, I think it's really made me who I am today. I think in every country that I've lived in, I've had to reestablish myself, particularly as an adult. I mean, as a child, you're just going through the motions. You're moving. You're trying to figure out who you are in each of those sort of continents. But as an adult, I realized very early on that you can be living in a city full of millions of people, but you can feel really alone if you don't have good, meaningful connections. And I experienced that very vividly, particularly when I was living in Hong Kong. I was visiting my husband at the time. He was working overseas for a few months, and I visited him for a couple of weeks. I was in a hotel room all day while he was at work all day. And I remember walking through the streets of Hong Kong feeling, wow, I can see the hustle and bustle of life. Everyone's ready to, you know, get to the next thing. But I felt so alone. I had no friends at the time as a visitor. And it was really very eye-opening for me. So I realized, you know, over time, that painful experience really taught me that you have to be the change. You have to go out and create new friendships, new connections, new communities, because that's how you build that space of really recognizing that, you know, we are social beings and we thrive on social connection. And you feel more rooted in identity when you're able to really express and be authentic to who you are within each of the continents that I was in.
Well, I think this is a really interesting concept because, you know, today we're more digitally connected than we've ever been before. Mm-hmm. But personally connected and connected to other people, we've kind of broken that, haven't we?
Absolutely. I speak about that in my first TEDx talk, The One Skill AI Can't Replace. I speak about, you know, human connection. I think that's something that we're losing more rapidly, particularly with the interface of technology that we can access now through our fingertips. You know, where we can have thousands of followers, millions of followers, you can have hundreds of likes and a comment and comments. But who can you go to when something happens in your life? Who can you pick up? Who can you call when you need that person, that sort of helping hand? I think we've lost that because it's easier. It's more convenient to send a text message or send a WhatsApp and say, hey, happy birthday, as compared to picking up the phone and really connecting and saying, how are you doing? What's going on within your life today? And just building on the cues that you get from actually speaking to someone or looking at them face to face, the body language, the tone, we've lost that ability to even pick up on those subtle cues because now everything is so virtual. And so I think that's one of the big pieces that I speak about in a lot of the work that I do is how do we cultivate that authentic connectivity, particularly for younger generations that are thriving on.
Oh, that's good. You know, I think that younger generations are, it's something that they have to learn. Speaking of that, you know, you shared a little bit about in your TED Talk, your childhood filled with noise and laughter and deep connection, but also a little bit about cultural silencing, especially for girls. How do those early lessons continue to influence the way you parent and think about this today?
You know, my childhood was great. I mean, I had a lot of good memories. I had some tough memories, and I think that's part of everybody here. I think anyone listening will have a mixed bag of emotions when it comes to their childhood or their upbringing. You know, for the large part, I was surrounded by warmth. I was surrounded by connection and community growing up. You know, I come from a very big extended family. And so every weekend, there's family gatherings, there's birthdays or anniversaries or some celebration. There were lots of meaningful conversations with people, with friends. We didn't grow up in the age of technology, so we had the rotary phones. You know, we didn't have dial-up internet back in those days. And so you engage very meaningfully with friends and with family. At the same time, in ICOM, my roots are, you know, I'm from an Indian background, Indian Portuguese background. And so there are cultural expectations that are, I think, ingrained at a very young age. And so I could see it in how my mom or my aunts were treated and in the expectations that there were for them as women versus for men. And which is why I speak about in my TED Talk about modeling and why it is so important. And so I think about what I observed, because these were all unspoken. They're not spoken expectations. They're unspoken, but they were observed.
Yeah.
And so that's why I talk very much about modeling. And so when I now today as a mom of two girls, and am I no means perfect, I think it's taken a lot of work and a lot of unlearning to really think through what are the cultural and societal expectations that I had absorbed. And I work very hard when I'm, you know, with my daughters to bring that awareness to the conversations I have with them when they're facing challenges at school or challenges even at home. You know, I don't want to silence their voice, although sometimes that's a default mechanism because that's how I was raised. Like, don't speak up. Be quiet. Listen. It takes a lot of awareness for me, conscious awareness, to help them, you know, share their voice. But how do you do that in a way that is respectful? How do you do that in a way that is kind? Mm. And so I'm very conscious in how I parent today than I probably was a few years ago. And I think that's taken a lot of unlearning on my part. And by no means am I perfect. I will have moments where I default, but I think it's a step-by-step process and I work every day at it.
Oh, I love that. I love that. So in your daughters, what do you notice a little bit different about them, you being their mom, having this knowledge and how they see the world and view the world and some aha moments for you in raising those girls?
Well, I think, I mean, I don't know if it's just my daughters. I think maybe perhaps I've seen, you know, in this generation, I think what I do love about them is they're very vocal and they will speak up. And if there's something that they don't like, or if, you know, if I've said to her, you shouldn't be doing this, and they go, well, but that person did that too. And so they will always try to defend themselves, which in a way it's good. They're standing up, you know, a strong young girl. But I think again, It's that balance that I have between sharing your voice, but also being respectful when sharing your voice so that you don't come off as, and women are labeled in many different spaces as if you speak up, you are labeled as, you know, you're the troublemaker, you're the problematic person, you're very opinionated. And so trying to, you know, work towards that balance is something that I struggle with sometimes. And so I'm very mindful of how I do that with my girls. But I know that them, compared to who I was at a young age, they're much more vocal. And I'm appreciative of that. I'm grateful for that.
Well, I love that. You know, I have two girls too, and they're very vocal. They speak their mind. But
yes.
I appreciated that when they were younger, because that's one thing that I think we all have a challenge with is ruling our tongue.
Yes.
And how do we understand how to rule our tongue properly to be more influential and not get us into trouble? Because a tongue can get you into trouble.
Yes.
Without going through that process and having your parents say, you know, that's probably something you should bite your tongue on, or that was really good. You should speak up about that.
Yeah.
I think that's very wise. You are wise.
It's a tough balance, but I think there's also teaching our kids to lean into intuition as well. And that's something no one ever teaches us, you know, that inner voice. If something doesn't feel right, then, you know, speak up, but also do so in a way that you can build compassion and empathy in the way that you come across. There's a way of communicating, right? And again, that's another aspect of the skills that we are losing over time. How do you communicate in a way that is influential, but also compassionate and empathetic towards the situation, towards the context, as opposed to just clearly being, you know, I'm going to speak up because this is the right thing to do.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We're hung by the tongue, so to speak. You know,
I love that.
Hung by the tongue. I think there's, you know, Proverbs talks a lot about the tongue and ruling it and things like that. But it's you know, King Solomon was pretty wise in his.
Indeed.
His talking about that. But it's something that I think we have a challenge now where I can put something in a post, a text, a writing, and it doesn't have the context of facial expression, mm-hmm. of tonality, of emphasis on different voices, of yes. hand gestures, functional gestures. Yes. And so the meanings can be interpreted different ways. And I think we interpret meanings differently from not having that connection live that you're so passionate about. It's such a interesting time that we live in.
It absolutely is. I mean, I know there's so many people that speak about it in this space about intonation is lost, and that's where misunderstandings and conflict can arise from. And so how do we bring that back into the conversation without losing the ability of the benefit of technology? And I think that's something that would be a game changer. And hopefully with time, this is where we need the in-person communication. This is where we need the ability to understand body language and facial expressions. I mean, that is huge. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing, and I rightly agree with you, so many of the comments that you see online on social media, they are so direct, they're so blunt, and there's a lack of understanding or empathy in the comments that there's a person on the other end of that.
Yeah.
Receiving those comments. So would you speak this way if that person were in front of you? Just asking that question can really shift whether, you know, is it appropriate to write this in that form?
Yeah, tact. It's very interesting. One of the challenges I grew up with was dyslexia.
Yes.
And so when somebody sends me an email or when somebody sends me a post, I'll read things into it that aren't there. So if somebody says, please don't, I say, I miss the don't, or please do, you know, yeah. There's a connection. And so instinctively, I went to react yes. to something that wasn't there and yes. reading into something too much. And so it's taken me many years to figure out, okay, Jim, slow down.
Yeah.
And, you know, be a little more disciplined with your responses. And there are times when you want to have a oral communication with somebody versus mm-hmm. a written communication, because there's a different dynamic. You know, okay. This is what a meeting's for. This is what a one-on-one's for. This is what an email. And so there's different tacks and different aspects of that. And I think connection, you know, where you're going to as far as the connection and being disconnected and trying to get the people connected is spot on for this time. So why do you think disconnection, more than AI, more than the economy, more than politics, is the crisis of our time?
That's a great question. You know, for me, this is my fundamental belief that I believe that disconnection is the root of all of those crises. I mean, if I ask the question, who creates the challenges that we're currently facing? So if you look at the political challenges that we have in our world, the economic uncertainty, the unchecked ethical implications of AI, which is continually evolving on a regular basis, who creates all of these? It's people. It's their mindset. It's the way they think. It's the beliefs that they have internalized from, you know, years, decades, centuries of antiquated historical events. And so you think about that. People create tension. Tension can result in conflict. And unchecked conflict can create wars. And that's the world we're living in today. And so I fundamentally believe that if when you look at an innocent child, you look at a baby, you know, they're so innocent. They're the purest form of life that we have. And if you believe that every human being is created for a purpose, and then ask yourself, what is my purpose? And I think majority of people don't go about their daily lives saying, what is my purpose? Who am I here to serve? What abilities do I have that I can use in a positive way to impact people? I think if we ask those important pieces of questions that can connect us to ourselves, we're less likely to create negative impact in the world. And so that's why I say disconnection is the root of these crises, because people are so driven now by an external world, by power, by greed, by control, that they are completely disconnected from themselves and from the people around them and the impact that their actions can have on other human beings. And I think that's why, for me, I see it as the one legacy we can't afford to pass down. If we can teach people how to be more connected to their purpose, to their values, you know, to really anchor down, then I'm sure that the output of that, the outcome of that, will ripple out in a positive way to their into their communities, to their families, to people all around. And so if every individual is doing that, you're less likely to see wars and conflict. You're more likely to see peace and joy and gratitude and love. And that's unfortunately, you know, so much of what we're lacking in today's world, because we live in a world where it's all about how can we be the best? How can we show up in a certain way? How can we get more money? How can we gain more power? How can we get more control? And I think that comes as a result of human beings fundamentally being disconnected from who they were created to be.
Yeah. How can we get more likes?
Yes. Yep.
Excuse me. That's something that I think a lot of people, you know, are very self-focused. And when you focus on yourself and you're in yourself, it's hard to have joy and happiness. You know, when you have that external focus and trying to make those connections, I think it makes a big difference in your mental outlook, your happiness, your joy. I think you're really onto something there. Now, you describe modeling as a hidden curriculum of every family, team, and workplace. How can leaders become more intentional about the blueprints they're handing down?
I think awareness. Okay. First, the recognition that what we model becomes someone else's mirror, that how we behave, how we show up when people are not watching can sometimes create, again, a ripple effect to people around us that's invisible, that we don't really realize. And so from a leader perspective or a parent perspective, if you can just think about it, if my team or if my child could learn something from my example, what would they learn? And I think when you ask yourself that question, you're trying to think about how am I showing up, and am I showing up in the best way possible that allows me to be able to impact my team members in a positive way? Now, I'm not saying leaders have to show up as having all the answers and having it perfect. Nobody has all the answers. I mean, that's why you have a team. That's why you have people around you, so that you can collaborate effectively to be able to solve a problem or create something meaningful. But it's about how am I showing up? You know, the real curriculum comes, how do you treat people when no one's watching? And I think that's, for me, is one of the fundamental aspects when I think about modeling as a hidden curriculum.
I love that. That is so good. You know, you were also talking about something I really love. It's called moving from performance to presence. Yeah. And why it's so difficult, and what, you know, I want to get into that, you know, the first step. For someone listening who feels stuck in that performance model. And I want to give you a little bit of context. I remember sitting with somebody who was going through a very, very difficult loss.
Yeah.
And there were two people sitting aside this person. One was just there, being present, being quiet. And the other one felt like they had to perform, or they had to give some incredible wisdom during this difficult time. And discerning that wasn't what the person needed. They needed presence. They didn't need performance. But I'd like you to take a deeper dive into that. Help me understand what that is and how do people move into that, and why is that so important?
I think, you know, performance for me is in a metric-driven world, in a world that thrives on the external validation, I think performance is safe, right? If you are performing, then you are part of the norm. You are considered that you know your stuff, or you're doing what society thinks that you should be doing. Presence requires vulnerability. Presence requires you to be really authentic, to be really tuned in to the person, A, to yourself, but also to the context, the environment. So in this situation, really tuning into the other person and what they are going through, and really asking yourself, what do they need from me in this moment? It's easy. It's the default mechanism for us to sort of perform, to try to solve a problem, to try to show up and, you know, say the right things and be a certain way, thinking that that is what the person needs. But presence requires you to really dig deeper down and say, how do I show up in a vulnerable state right now so I can really connect to this person who is experiencing one of the most challenging things in life? And I think a lot of people in today's world struggle to be vulnerable because there's this fear of judgment. There's this fear of, you know, not maintaining that facade of perfection. Like we live in a world where everything needs to be perfect. Everything must be perceived perfect. I mean, you just look at AI, you know, images and you have perfection all over it. And so I think when you think about, you know, moving from performance to presence, it's really asking yourself, and I talk about this in my TED Talk about three questions that I, you know, have created for myself. You know, who are you performing for? You know, we're all performing by nature, right? We wake up in the morning, we put on our face, we go out, you know, we have one version of ourselves that we present to the world. And most people will have this, you know, same version at home. Some people will have a different version at home. And so you have to really ask yourself, who are you performing for? Are you performing for the world? Are you performing for yourself in alignment with who you are being? You know, asking yourself, what belief is keeping me there? And who do I want to become? So these are three questions that I've ingrained as part of my own practice. But that's how I have moved from sometimes performing to really being present, you know, standing out authentically, even against the norm. And I think, you know, I'll give you an example probably maybe when we dive down into some of the other questions. But I think for me, awareness, like I've mentioned in my previous response, is the key to any change, to any shift you want to make in life. Because right now we are living by default. We are living on autopilot. We do things without ever having the conscious awareness that we are showing up sometimes inauthentically for other people's expectations, for societal norms. And we don't realize that it's actually in misalignment with who we are. So I think when you're shifting from performance to presence, getting vulnerable with yourself first so that you can then tune in to the people around you to really grasp and gather what is it that they need from you in that moment.
Oh, that's so good. And I think, you know, self-awareness is the start of self-leadership. And if you can't lead yourself, you can't lead others. But self-awareness, you know, I use the story often about self-awareness when I was just turned 22. The one thing that I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, beyond anything, I knew this, that I didn't have a drinking problem and I wasn't an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And by the time I was 23, I'm like, wow, my self-awareness was really off in that area. And once that veil was lifted, I started a journey of self-awareness, of having these aha moments that were just game changing, and surrounding myself and connecting with people that were for me, that I could be vulnerable with.
Yeah.
I think that was a guide to helping me become even more self-aware.
Yeah.
But self-awareness, what are some tools, tricks, thoughts that you think of that people can do to become more self-aware?
I think it's, you know, it first starts, we talk about, you know, living by default. And we talk about the fact that our brains are wired to, you know, be habits of creatures. So everything that we do tends to be out of habit of doing the same thing over and over again every single day. So much so that you become unconscious doing it. And for an example I can give is you can get out and into the car and you'll start driving. And before you know it, you've reached a certain point, but you may not remember changing lanes or signaling. Like your body has automatically become gone unconscious while driving, while you're thinking about something. Maybe you're thinking about the meeting or the conversation you're about to have. And so when you talk about awareness, it's about how to step out of that automatic autopilot behavior and ask yourself intentionally, how am I showing up in this case? Who am I being in this case? And I'll give you an example. So, you know, not too long ago when I was starting out in this work, you know, have a young child, a toddler at the time. And, you know, as toddlers do, they throw tantrums when they don't get what they want. And my default mode at the time would be to scold her and, you know, to sort of blame her. You're not listening. You're not doing this. Why are you not listening? And that was my default parenting mode, also because of how I was raised and, you know, cultural sort of norms around that. But when I started to do the work, I had to recognize that that was not what she needed in that moment. Me scolding her was not going to stop the behavior or make her feel any better. It was actually understanding that I needed to be vulnerable with her. I needed to get down to her level. I needed to understand why she was throwing a tantrum or why she was upset and really make that eye-to-eye contact, give her a hug, calm her nervous system down. And I think for me to do that required, before I react, before my default reaction to scold her, I had to stop and recognize, Michelle, that's not the thing that you need to do in this situation. This is how you need to be. And so it's a conscious process that takes effort, but it's hard in the beginning, but the more often you practice it, it becomes much easier. And I think it's an example of, you know, just the performance to presence kind of analogy, because we can often be in a store where our kids are throwing tantrums or something's happening and your default mode is, oh my God, what are the people thinking about me? And, you know, and so you can think about that. Am I performing and I'm going to parent my child in front of everybody? Or are you going to get down to your child's level and parent the way that you should parent and be more present with your child? So those are sorts of the changes that I've made from actually being able to recognize that awareness in how I am showing up is the first important step for making any change in your life, whether it's with your kid, whether it's at work, whether it's with your partner or your spouse. How do you show up? Is it really how you want to be and how you want to live and what you want to say? And if it's not, then become aware of that and start that process of change.
Yeah, that's so good. You know, I'm thinking about when my daughter was younger, and my youngest daughter, Maddie, she was a strong-willed child. And I knew that I needed to, there was discipline, but there were sometimes arguments and fights that were upset, run to the room, slam the door, give her a couple minutes, wait, open the door, go in, have that presence, sit on the bed, be silent, say, what's going on? How are you doing, Maddie? And she would say, I don't get no loving. I said, you need some loving. She goes, yeah, I need some loving. And I said, okay. And, you know, just having that moment there of taking the tension down, being present, choosing your battles, you know, you're not going to have a battle on if she wants to go out and start juggling knives outside, running. You know, that's a battle where you're going to say no. If she's not going to eat all of her broccoli, that's not a battle I'm going to die on. You know, we're looking at those different things. But I think about, you know, your idea of presence and performing, and I really think that hits home and resonates with me.
Yeah, and if I can share another example around that, you know.
Yeah.
As an entrepreneur, I think there's a lot of pressure to show up on social media, right? To be out there. And of course, it's important because if people don't know who you are or who you serve, then you're not able to make impact. So I get that it's important. But as I ventured out into this world, into this entrepreneurship world, I've realized that there's a balance between, you know, how I need to show up versus what, you know, cultural norms or expectations are around showing up. And so for me, it's not about, I mean, I need to show up. So there's this performance. I need to show up 5 days a week. I need to post. I need to like. I need to comment. I need to do all of these things in order to gain traction. There's that performance pressure. But I've made the conscious decision that, yes, I am going to show up, but I'm going to be more present and more authentic in when I show up. So for me, that may be a couple of times a week. Sometimes that may not be on a week at all. If I've had something happen and I need to be more present in the real world with my family, with a loved one, with the challenge that I'm facing. So I'm very, you know, very attuned, very self-aware in that I want to lead with authenticity. I want to show up authentically when I do show up. And so that's an example of, you know, how we can move from performance to pressure. We can either conform and do what everybody's doing and use AI to generate our post and do all of the things that we must do in order to gain traction and gain likes and gain comments and become more known in the space. Or you can choose to, yes, do all those things, but do it in a way that feels right for you, that aligns with who you are, that doesn't put that pressure on you to perform in a way that is out of alignment with who you are as a human being. So that's kind of an example that I apply every day in my daily life. I do feel it. I do feel the pressure to perform, but I'm very conscious in making the decision that, you know, today I'm not going to post and it's okay. The world's not going to fall apart if Michelle doesn't post.
I like it. Let's shift gears a little bit. One of the things I'm fascinated with is, you know, you've got your PhD, you've got your MBA, you're very educated, and you have a passion for teaching. I'm autodidactic, you know, self-taught from, you know, music to reading 100 books a year and going through that process. And there are a lot of gaps today. You know, you're probably seeing in traditional education. What are some of the things that you think we're missing in traditional education right now?
I think there are lots of pros for traditional education, but traditional education was built for a different century. Mm-hmm. And we've evolved so rapidly that I think education needs to evolve to match the needs of our future generations. So there's obviously a lot of digital literacy and AI-built tools that are coming into the education space. However, what I think is being lost or wasn't really a strong focus on is what we traditionally call the soft skills. I like to call it the human skills.
Okay.
The skills of empathy, the skills of collaboration, the skills of connection, of being able to really lead with authenticity, resilience, flexibility. These are the skills that I think we've not clearly developed in traditional education, but it needs to be more developed in today's modern education, just because of where technology is headed and the skills that we're now losing as a result of technology. Those are some of the gaps that I've seen as an educator working across the different spaces. I think around 2015, I was working in Australia and I saw a huge shift in kids, I shouldn't say kids, young adults coming through and, you know, academically sound. So obviously they were, you know, I taught in medical school, so ability to really manage the academic load, but they can start to crumble under the pressure when things don't go according to plan, that resilience starts to be impacted in some learners. That trend increased over time. So then when I was in England, you know, in Hong Kong and England, you start to see more and more young adults coming to university with needs of accommodation, you know, needing extra time to sit through assessments. There's a lack of accountability that I saw across the board. And again, I don't want to generalize because not every student or learner is like that, but we started to see increasing trends of challenges with mental health, challenges with, you know, accountability. It's not my fault that the exam was hard. It's your fault because you made the exam hard. I mean, that's what we often dealt with many times. And so, you know, where did that challenge come from? And I think Jonathan Haidt, who's published his recent book, The Anxious Generation, he speaks about this trend in terms of the impact, the huge substantial impact on connection, on mental health. And you start to see this shift happening around the age of 2015, where there was this increasing use of technology on social media, more and more teenagers connecting within that space, therefore losing the ability of real meaningful connection in the real world. And so you started to see an increased shift in isolation, in anxiety, in depression. And so over time, I think, you know, how education has to shift is how do we bring authentic human connection back to education in a way that is sustainable, in a way that is a good balance of both leveraging digital technologies where it enhances and makes us efficient without compromising the human skills we need to be able to marry the two and have successful creative solutions moving forward.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think that, you know, I've hired a lot of very talented people, very high IQ, absolutely zero EQ, mm-hmm. and they could get the thing done, but they can become toxic to an environment so much so that I would rather take somebody who is less skillful that I can develop that won't kill the culture.
Yeah.
And that can be sometimes a challenge, especially with personality types that just want to get the job done. I don't care. Give me the person who can get it done. I want it done in a week. This guy's going to take 3 weeks. This gal's going to take 4 weeks. I just want somebody to bulldoze through and get the job done. But there's a diminishing return and there's a negative effect for that. So, you know, when you talk about emotional intelligence, resilience, digital literacy, I think those are very crucial for this digital age that we're in.
It is. And I mean, the World Economic Forum, their Future of Jobs report that they put out recently speaks to these skills as being core skills of the future, you know, flexibility, agility, adaptability, critical thinking. I mean, we have AI, ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude that can do a lot of thinking for us. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what is our dependency on that to be able to actually create new innovative solutions? You still need to be able to craft meaning out of what is being produced by these AI tools. So those are the skills of the future. They're recognizing it. So some jobs are going to be replaced, but new jobs are going to be created. Absolutely. However, within all of those, you still need these core foundational human skills. And I think that's hopefully, you know, we can bridge that gap. We still have time that, you know, within education systems, within the workplaces, we recognize the importance and the emphasis of these skills and create programs to be able to support learners and to support our employees as well.
Yeah, I think that is very, very insightful, very wise on your part. We're in this digital age of distraction. And I think about, you know, you mentioned it's one of the greatest battles that we're having to deal with at this time. I think about if I was going to go through and kill an organization, what I would do is I would focus on distraction.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding that is one of our greatest battles. Why do you think most adults are losing this battle, and what is it costing our next generation?
I think it comes down to lack of awareness, right? Mm. We are living in the most connected times in history. Everywhere you look, we have something to distract us, whether it's at our phone and our fingertips with our phones and the millions of apps that are on it, to social media notifications that pop up, to online streaming. You know, we always have access to something external to distract us from any internal dialogue that we need to have with ourselves. And so I think adults are losing that battle because A, they're not recognizing that it's the battle. And I'm a very faith-based person. And if I were to, you know, I fundamentally believe that we are all created for a purpose. We know that there's good and there's evil in this world. And so if you are created for purpose, and if there is good and if there is evil in this world, then the way to distract someone from fulfilling their purpose is to keep them busy, to keep them always switched on to something external so that they don't have the time to really connect meaningfully to themselves. Yeah, to ask.
Have you ever read the,
you know, who am I? Sorry, I think we're chopping off and getting a little disconnected here.
Have you ever read the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis?
No, I have not, but now I'm going to have to.
Well, it talks about distraction in that, you know, and that was it's these demons trying to keep this person miserable. And distraction was one of the keys that they used. And I thought it was really interesting. He was talking about this back in the 50s. I don't know when he wrote that book, but it was very fascinating. The Screwtape Letters. You'll have to read it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to read that. I mean, I think so, you know, to answer your question, this generation is growing up observing as adults being overstimulated, underconnected, because majority of our connections happen virtually, and just starved of the ability to be still. I mean, I have my children, even though I'm in this work, I will still have questions. Mommy, can I have your phone? Mommy, I'm bored, you know? And so they're sitting in the car right there. I'm bored. I'm like, look out the window. Let's play an alphabet game.
Mm-hmm.
So there's constant need for stimulation. And they, you know, it can happen in young kids as well, but it also depends on how are we showing up. And so I've made that fundamental shift in my family of how we show up so that I can start to allow my kids to be bored. It's good to be bored sometimes because that's how you can be creative as well.
Yeah, the lost art of thinking or learning how to play. I think learning how to play is very, very important, especially with others. That they've done studies on how the next generation is coming up and they didn't have the playtime that the older generation did. And they're finding that that's killing some of the creativity and puzzle solving and problem solving abilities. And play is something very important.
Yes. And Jonathan Haidt talks about it in his book. You know, we've moved from a play-based childhood to a phone-based childhood. And he's absolutely spot on.
That's really good. Yeah, technology isn't going away. So we've got to think about how do we use that as a tool of connection instead of a barrier. And then the other question I was thinking about is, you know, parents are often asking, how do I prepare my child for a future shaped by AI? How do you answer that question?
So I'd like to probably start with the first question. You're right. Technology isn't going away. And none of this is saying that technology is bad, right? Technology has its benefits. I mean, we now have the ability to connect far and wide across the globe with our loved ones, with businesses all around the world. And that wasn't possible 20 years ago, 30 years ago, right? To the extent that it is today. And so it's not inherently bad. I think, you know, when it gets, when technology starts to control us, rather than us controlling technology.
That's good.
So how many times do you pick up your phone? How many times are you, you know, I'm just going to check this message. And then an hour later, you have doom scrolled through some of your social media platforms. You can be sitting with your loved one, but you're on your phone. You're physically present, but you're not present at all because your mind's in the virtual world somewhere in there. And so that's when technology can start to be harmful because it removes us from building the authentic connection pieces that we as human beings thrive on. So I really think that it needs to start with intention. How are you using technology? Are you using it as a tool to escape from feeling pain, from, you know, numbing, from something that's happened in your life and you just want to not feel that? I always say use technology to clear the noise, to help you become more efficient. And the time that you've gained from being efficient, use that to build real connections. Now, you can still use technology. You can call up somebody on FaceTime or, you know, video chat and connect with them. Still have a good conversation face to face. And, you know, how are you doing? And build those relationships so you can use and leverage technology in that way. But I think the key is intention. How are you using it? When you use it intentionally, you take back the power. You have control over when you are using technology and how you are using technology. So that would be my first thing. I think your second part of your question, if you don't mind repeating it, please, it was around parents.
It's parents asking that question. You know, we're living in an AI society. How do I prepare my child for the future that's shaped by AI? How do I help my child with that?
I think, and I feel like awareness is going to be my answer for a lot of these things.
Yeah.
Being really aware first of where we stand, the pros and cons of AI, and having very open conversations with our children around what AI can and cannot do. I mean, we've heard, you know, recently we've heard stories in the news last year as well. There were stories of young kids who have succumbed to the effects of AI, not realizing that AI has limitations. It's not a real person. It doesn't have empathy. It cannot have empathy. Even though it can simulate empathetic conversations, it is not a human being. And young kids have developed relationships with AI and have succumbed to, unfortunately, losing their lives over it. So how do you build meaningful conversations with your kids around AI can help us do this? It can help you understand why a problem works this way or how parts of our body works this way. It can help you understand certain questions. But it cannot craft meaningful connections. So I think awareness first around pros and cons, having then the conversation with your kids. And of course, I'm not saying with a 5 or 6 year old because they're not going to grapple with it. You know, age appropriate conversations with kids. And I think the third part is, you know, sitting with them as they're using it so that you can support them through their learning and understanding of it. I think sometimes if we leave them to their own devices, you know, lose that ability to sort of course correct, to be able to provide information, to provide some feedback. And I think those are really critical points in helping children learn that AI has its benefits, but there are some things that AI can't do. And so also it builds that connection because you're now sitting with your child and helping them and giving them the tools of how to navigate in a digital world, but navigate safely, navigate wisely. And so those are some of the tips that I think would be that I use in my own personal life. And I think hopefully will help other parents as well.
I think that's really good. I think one of the things that I try and explain to people is, you know, AI is wonderful. I use it all the time. But without real intelligence guiding it, it's not going to be as effective. And I said the other challenge to people is if they don't have discernment, they can't recognize what's good and what's bad in AI. So, for example, somebody says, I want it to write an email for me, it can write an email. But to look at that email and see some of the platitudes and the cliches and the things that it dumps in there, to have the discernment to say, I hope this email finds you well. It's so overused and so AI-ish that it doesn't connect. It doesn't land. But when you take AI and you say, yeah, this is pretty good. I'm trying to find three metaphors that would align with this so I can communicate better. It gives you great insight. And you're thinking, oh, I don't like this one. I don't like this one. This one would work, but can I tweak it? Can I get better? Can I take it in different area? I think discernment is so important. And you've got to get to where you're well-read. You have some education to have that discernment, because otherwise you see people who don't use real intelligence with the AI.
Yes.
They become lazy and they don't understand that most people see that as very formulaic in their communication.
Yes, 100%. And that's where I mean, you know, that's what I mean by really sitting with your children and having that practiced to help them understand and recognize, to discern, you know, what is acceptable, what is very sort of AI crafted, and how to really make sure that you shine in your communications as well. Because I think we're seeing a lot of that, seeing so much of content being poured out. And a lot of it, sometimes you can tell when it's been crafted by AI. So how do you bring your authenticity to that? Because I think that's what we're losing as well. You know, in addition to connection, people are losing their authenticity because they're trying to perform in a way that, again, it's an automated, it's artificial intelligence is generating a lot of our content. So where do you shine within that? And so recognizing how to use AI to leverage, to craft meaningful sort of content. But I think that comes from practice. It's a learning space, especially for young adults and kids that are using it.
Oh, that's good. I like it. Let's talk a little bit about leadership, legacy, and impact. You know, you said that influence isn't about titles or platforms.
Yeah.
It's how we show up. It's how, thinking about how can leaders model connection and high performance workplaces that are filled with deadlines, KPIs, screens, all that good stuff. So talk to me about that. What is real influence?
I think for me as a leader, and I've been in leadership roles in many spaces and different continents, I think for me, being a leader is showing up as a human being first. You know, I always say the success of an organization is based on the people in it. It's not your output, that's what you achieve together, but it's the people. So if you can be influenced, it's about how do you build trust in your people? Well, how do you build trust? You show them you care. You are empathetic. You have genuine connections first. So every time I would show up to team meetings with my team, it was all about connection first. How are you? What's going on in your life? And we'd share some conversation, something funny or something hard that was happening. And through that vulnerability, you build trust. You build a safe space to be able to say, you know, I see you, I hear you, I'm here for you. And you can then pull together as a team to be able to produce incredible output. So for me, influence is about building that connection. So admit when you've made a mistake. Ask questions. Don't judge. Don't be quick to sort of point fingers. How do you make eye contact with people? Hmm. How do you make them feel seen and heard? And so every leader that I have worked with and I've written an article recently about this, that really for me was an incredible role model, was a leader who was very present, got to know me on a level that is outside of just you are an employee in this organization, and really cared about how can I help you grow as well. Where do you want to be and how can I help you get there? I think that's what I see as a true leader in building influence. It's not just about titles, because you can be out on the street. Nobody knows who you are unless you're, you know, the big household names. Nobody knows who you are, but how do you treat people? How do you make them seen? I think that for me is a true leader. And that's what presence really looks like.
Well, that's really good. What advice would you give some leaders who think that, are they worry or are consumed with the thought that presence and empathy will make them look soft in a result-driven culture?
I think there are certainly leaders who think that. And so they put on a facade, you know, a very stoic form of leadership. But I've worked in many spaces and I've seen both. And I will say that if you show people your soft side, and no one's asking you to bear, you know, all your, you know, what they say, dirty laundry, and bear everything to your team. But if you can show a human side to you, an empathetic side, a vulnerable side to you, you will see how differently your people will show up. Because when you are in a tough spot, your people will show up for you. Yes, if you're a very, you know, you've got this facade and you want to avoid that showing that side of you, you will still perform. Your team will still perform. But where I see the difference is you may not get the best performance that you could have from those people had you shown them a human side to it. And again, the success of an organization is based on the people. You treat your people well, you care about them, you will get incredible results because they trust you, they see you, they feel seen, they're going to want to show up for you. And that's been my experience in every organization where I've had an incredible leader at the top.
Well, I like that. I like that. There's a lot of times where people don't understand the different personalities. I think this is very, very important because there are people, I use the analogy of a football coach. He has two quarterbacks. One of them, both of them in an example would score 3 touchdowns. And the coach goes up to the one who really likes challenge and grows out of that challenge and says, you know, if you work a little harder, you could have scored 5. And he goes, yeah, that's right, coach. I could have. Yeah. Thanks for that. I appreciate that. But then there's the other quarterback that the coach says the exact same thing to. Mm-hmm. And he refers back to the coach, or he says in his mind, it's like, I gave you 3 touchdowns. Well, how about a little bit of pat on the back for those? Yeah. And so understanding that person and how they're going to receive that and the proper balance of support and challenge is where you really liberate your team. And that, I think, is a key to leadership. But I think understanding those personalities and how to communicate differently to different personalities is important.
Yes. Indeed.
When you use the language of legacy, what's the difference between success versus leaving behind success versus leaving behind connection?
I think success is great. Success comes, but success fades. And if you think about connection, people will always forget. There's that saying, people will always forget what you do, but they'll never forget how you made them feel. So I think for me, connection, I'm not saying success is not important. Success is important. But how can you do both at the same time? How can you become successful, but also ensure that you bring people along the way with you, that you are, you know, an empathetic, authentic human being that can elevate people alongside your success. So it's not just about you. Being a leader is not just about you at the top. It's about how do you bring everybody with you? How do you hold them accountable? How do you elevate them in the ways that they want to grow and connect with them on a deeper level so that you are making everyone successful? That to me is true success. It's not just about my own sort of ambitions. It's about how do I elevate a team and their ambitions as well.
I like that. Let's think about some practical takeaways for our audience here. Think about some daily or weekly practices that help you stay grounded and connected in this noisy digital world. So what are some of the things that you do to kind of put into practice those things?
For me, it's a morning routine. I'm a morning person. So probably is a little easier for me than it is for, you know, someone that's not a morning person. Regardless, the reason I do it in the morning is because if I'm waking up before the hustle and bustle of the day, before all of the responsibilities that are upon me, the tasks that I need to achieve, I need to ensure that I am showing up as the best version of me. And so I have a morning practice where I'm usually up anywhere between 30 minutes to an hour, sometimes longer, before, you know, everybody else in the household is up. And I've devoted that time for prayer, for reflection, for meditation, just quiet time.
Yeah.
It can be exercise if you're not into meditation or anything. It can be, you know, just a walk outdoors, just grounding yourself in nature, just quiet time to sit with yourself, to maybe just have some internal dialogue. How do I want to show up today? I have all of these things that I need to achieve. Who do I want to be when I'm undertaking these tasks? You know, mm-hmm. How am I going to act when things go awry? just asking yourself those questions and pausing and setting an intention for the day, for me, I find has been really helpful. There are days where I don't get a chance to do that because I've probably been too tired and I don't wake up. And I notice myself reacting more on those days. I notice myself getting more anxious or more stressed. And so for me, my morning routine is something that I usually keep as a non-negotiable. It is something that I will do 98% of the time. So, and it's been really grounding and game-changing for me.
I like that. I love the morning routine. I think that is wise to have a morning routine. If somebody is feeling burnt out or disconnected or stuck on autopilot, what's a practical thing that they could do today to bring them back to that reconnection journey?
I have what I do as an attention audit. So I think awareness, right? It all comes back to how do I become aware of how I'm showing up. So as part of this attention audit, you know, I'll give you simple tools. It's a much more in-depth audit that I do in my work. But really starting with, you know, where did my energy go today? So at the end of the day, thinking about where did my energy go today? Out of the things that I did, what filled me? What drained me? And thinking about where do I want to be? How do I want to show up? Just those three questions for me at the end of a day can give you enough information as to where, you know, what were the things or who were the people that you were with that filled your cup, that empowered you, that brought out the best in you? And what were the things and who were the people that drained you, that made you feel less than? And then bringing that awareness. So what do I need to do? How can I be 1% better tomorrow? Just thinking through that for me as an attention audit. Again, it's a very high level tool that I'm sharing with you now. It's a much more in-depth tool that I do within my program to really help people uncover some of the habits that we formed over time and how we can start to break them.
Oh, I like that. Now, you've spoken also about faith and alignment versus applause. How does your personal faith shape the way you lead and teach today?
I think it goes back to the example I shared about, you know, the performance over presence. I think there's a lot of challenge and pressure that, you know, as an entrepreneur trying to build my personal brand, you know, wanting success, wanting to be able to make impact, there's that pressure. But I also, as a person of faith, I lean into, you know, I am here for a purpose. And that purpose will take time and it will reveal itself in its own time. So I'm not here to do something to get applauded for it. I'm here to be able to make meaningful impact one person at a time. And so it's an internal quiet alignment that I have. And so sometimes there will be moments where, you know, the voices, the inner critic comes up and says, Michelle, you're not doing enough, or you're not getting these many likes, or you're not making impact. And I have to always step back and say that everything happens in its divine timing. And for me, it's just my obedience to my purpose that will outlast, you know, the external validation that that I need.
I love that. That's so good. Tell me this, what gives you hope about the next generation, even in the midst of all this distraction?
I think I alluded to that before when I said, you know, my daughters are very vocal. Mm-hmm. So I think we are living at a time where this generation, you know, they ask the hard questions. They stand up when, you know, we've conformed and we've, you know, our previous generations have done things because that's the way it was done and that's what you do. This generation will speak up and say, no, this isn't working for me. And so I think it gives me hope because there is that hunger for, you know, fairness and equity and meaning. And I think, you know, through that thirst, they're going to hopefully create and see the awareness that digital distraction is causing and create a better future for themselves and for their children and a more connected world.
Very good. Very good. So any questions that I should have asked you that I didn't?
Gosh, I think there were lots of questions. I do offer a program to help people rewire their brains, so to help them move out of autopilot thinking, to help them move into more purpose-driven sort of alignment with their lives. It's called the program that's developed by Dr. Joe Dispenza. It's a Neuro Change Solutions program. It's Change Your Mind, Create New Results, and it's based on neuroscience. So a lot of research. It's been offered to multiple organizations. And the greatest impact that I've seen come from it is the ability to really shift someone's perspective and awareness within 12 hours or less than. It's a powerful program. It's been delivered. I've delivered it to many people in my circle, and I've seen the impact. And so it's, you know, if anyone's interested, just check out my website, michelledmachado.com, and there's a program on neurochange solutions, and you'll be able to contact me through there if it's of interest to anyone in the audience.
Yeah, I'll put the link in the description so you can connect there. But I want to thank you for the time that we spent today. I learned a lot. I have this was a feast of information, and I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much, Jim, for having me. And I learned too as well from the conversations that we've had. It's an incredible honor, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
Thanks. Till next time.